blanket approach to drugs that fails to distinguish between your more benign drugs like pot, say, and your more vicious drugs like crack, and I would say heroin. Anybody who doesn't have the familiarity with those differences, you know, it's a bit more complicated now than I might have thought of it 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
So in other words,
we don't know. I know that you can't have violent street gangs selling hard drugs off public streets without it absolutely destroying not only a lot of individuals' lives, but wrecking the neighborhood around it. Of that I remain fairly certain.
One solution, of course, that has been tried in Switzerland and Amsterdam, and it's been panned by drug prohibition warriors, of course, here, but like McAfee, you know, at the national level, or McAfee, I guess his name is. But it seems to have had some success, according to what I've read, is, in fact, legalization of heroin, you know, through other distribution sources that, in essence, removes it from the streets. I'm sure you've heard these arguments. Have you reached the point where you no longer favor, let's say, legalization of hard drugs through a medical treatment program solution, or you're...
Oh, I don't know. I've reached the point where I try to avoid forming opinions about stuff I don't feel passionately about or sufficiently informed about. Until that becomes more of an on-the-table proposal, I'll probably just refrain from...
The reason I mention the issue is because it is almost completely absent from this election race, in the sense that whereas the overwhelming majority of people in California prisons are there for non-violent drug-related offenses.
Yes, I'm aware that there's something grossly wrong. There's no doubt about that.
And even in this county, I would have to say there's probably, I mean, I haven't got the stats here, but I would say there certainly is, you know, a huge number of people in jail for drug use. And I don't just mean marijuana use, I mean, you know, amphetamines, cocaine.
Yeah, sure.
And, I mean, do you feel that such use should be criminal?
I don't know.
You've spoken out against selling, but what about use?
My experience is that those drugs, when you're talking about the harder drugs at least, the methamphetamines, the heroines, the coke and crack products, I see those things as, at least most of the time, really screwing up people's lives. Whether or not that is inherent or relative to the legalization issue, the criminalization of it, I don't really know. But it looks to me like, under the current circumstances, getting into those drugs tends to really screw people up.
We can probably agree with that, generally. But even more so, for instance, in fact, 100 to 1,000 times as much with drugs like alcohol and tobacco, which are legal. And the reason I bring up these tired arguments with you is because nobody has been talking about this at all locally, in terms of local elections. I guess you might say, well, what do we do locally? It's not going to make any difference. You know, it's the state.
Well, you tax it, right? That's what they just did to the liquor outlets to make money off of it.
Right. Well, what I'm saying is that none of the local candidates, they're all big for increasing police services, or I would consider it as police padding, because they're spending millions and millions of dollars on a new police station and sculptures. Thousands and thousands of dollars on sculptures there. And a lot of their money, a lot of police department money, is coming from this drug war. Because, of course, as you know, the criminalization fuels the police department budget.
Oh, yeah, it's big business.
You know, both to get rid of it and also because it corrupts them profoundly by the huge amounts of profits that can be made, you know, through this and the connections that happen there. I'm alarmed to see none of the candidates addressing this issue locally and addressing its implications locally. You know, instead, it's sort of everyone wants to give a blank check to the police department. I've heard no criticism of the police, with the exception of one candidate, Fitz Morris, who talked about his concern about the police review board being too weak and too off target. But, and I know that back in 1988, some of us who looked at Jane's campaign were alarmed at her focus on the drug war. Now, of course, we don't live in the beach flats, and we don't have cocaine dealers at 2 in the morning outside our house, and gangs running around causing problems. So it certainly is a different situation for many of us. But on the other hand, in a broader sense, this criminalization of people for using and selling drugs is, to me, a significant cancer in the body politic. Have you, do you take a different position on this?
No, I don't. I just don't, you know, at this point it seems like there are more germane issues. Not that what you're saying isn't absolutely pointing to one of the larger grim realities of the way society is right now. I'm just on the more plebeian level of trying to prevent the boardwalk from engulfing my neighborhood and home.
And unfortunately, I have to prevent my show from engulfing the next show, and I have to be out of here, so we can't hear the last 25 seconds of that interview. That was activist Phil Baer talking about the beach flats and letting us know that the so-called compromise was a loser, pretty much, and that we are losing, and I suggest you get your butts down to City Council at 3:30 and at 7 on Tuesday to try to cut our losses, or at least observe this wreck as it happens. Also on Thursday, of course, you can check out Bathroom Stairs Broadsides at 6. We'll be returning at 96.3 FM. There's also a meeting of the Homeless Service Center, which is the new name for the Homeless Community Resource Center. You can go to their board of directors meeting and actually check out the new pinup girl for Linda Steinau, Karen Gillette, in person. Check her out. Check out what's going on down there. I'm going to phase out now with a tune from Jekyll and Hyde, which is a great musical from a great horror movie. And, of course, the horror movie that we all live with is something that I'm going to leave with you, unfortunately, in your backyard, your front yard, and everywhere else. So come back with us, and we'll discuss that horror movie on Thursday, 6 o'clock. Thanks for being with me. See you then.
Society's must, in society's way, and the truth is that it's all a facade.
There's a face that we hide till the nighttime appears,
and what's hiding inside behind all of our fears
is our true self, locked inside the facade.
Everything, people in their own sweet way, lies around and goes on.
But there's one thing I know, and I know it for sure. This disease that we got has got no ready cure. And I'm certain life is terribly hard
when your life's a facade.
Look around you, I have found you cannot tell by looking at the surface what is lurking there beneath. See the face, no one who cares to bet you what you see, not what you get, cause man's a master of deceit.
So what is the sinister secret? The lie he will tell you is true.
It's that each man you make on the street isn't one man, but two.
Pretends to be a pillar of society, a model of propriety,
sobriety and fire. look behind the facade.
Yes, it's Bathrobe Spears Broadsides coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3. We're going to have interviews, we hope, live with Shadow's Edge Shannon, Dead On David Silver with the election update, possibly a special Huff report from Beggarbacker Becky Johnson, and interviews galore from Pacific Avenue, where police seem to be taking special delight in harassing people for such major crimes as hacky sacking, riding their bike the wrong way, and, quote, obstructing the sidewalk. We're going to have a lot of information on that, so stay with us, plus interviews, we hope, from out of town, including San Jose and John Malkin in San Francisco, and more. Go on and on and on, and hopefully the fire that we start will burn down the bad and set up the good. Got some old tinder that needs to be tossed into the fire. I'm thinking about the old policies of the old city council that are going to be going out 2 days from now. Actually, they have one more council meeting on the 10th after the election on November 3rd, and then the new council gets seated on November 24th. If we're lucky, we'll be able to get 3 good new council members in, progressives from the Crone, Fitzmaurice, Sugar, Clark group. And it looks like the first 3, Crone, Fitzmaurice, and Sugar, are going to be the people that I recommend you vote for city council. Not because I think they're going to do wonders for poor people and homeless people and civil rights. I have no such assurance, mainly because I have a serious fear of Steinau, Walton, and Quartararo. If any one of them gets in, the Rotkin majority remains in power. That's Riot Act Mike Rotkin, the shadow mayor of Santa Cruz, who brought you such things as 6 months in jail, $1,000 fine for one act of sleeping at City Hall under the injunction which he authored and passed. He attempted to close down City Hall entirely in 1996. He and Kennedy essentially have called the shots for the last 4 years, and it's time that was over. And if that means putting in some half-hearted liberals And I don't know that they're half-hearted. Maybe they're wholehearted. I just haven't heard enough during the election campaign to persuade me that they're strong on issues like police misconduct, ending police misconduct, and ending discrimination against homeless people downtown, on setting up real alternative facilities that include the entire community and don't just pander to the business downtown association, Linda Steinau, Rod Quartararo group, that is making a bid for power in this election. So I'd say Fitzmaurice, Cronin, Sugar, just like all the other progressive newspapers are saying, the Fish Wrap Live says that, City on a Hill Press says that, and I say it too. I'm afraid I'm going to regret it later, but I probably will regret it more, although it's hard to say, if one of Steinau, Walton, or Quartararo get in. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is your twice-weekly civil rights show, Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. Actually, we have many more shows than this that concern themselves with stuff on the streets and civil rights, and I'm hoping my producer will bring in a copy of the entire Free Radio schedule so I can give you some other shows to listen to. If you find the kind of discussion we have on this show interesting and informative, I'm not the only one who does this, and it's good that more people are really focusing on local issues of police misconduct, civil rights for poor people, just ongoing community issues that really are important to follow. I'm not a man who dislikes music. You're going to hear some music in a moment on this show, but I really think we got to talk with each other, communicate with each other, and discuss seriously what we need to do. Let each other know what's going on out there in order to change what's going on out there. So I'm your host, Bathrobe's Pierre Robert North. I do this show twice a week, 11 in the morning on Sundays and 6 o'clock in the evenings on Thursdays. And I invite you to join me, to give a call to 427-3772 if you've got any reaction to anything I've said, or issues about police misconduct, issues about civil rights for poor people. I also tend to delve a bit into the drug war, the drug prohibition war, I should say, the war on people, which funds the police departments and large criminals who sell these drugs, which helps to fund foreign wars run by the Central Intelligence Agency and lied about by the New York Times. I'm going to read today from High Witness News, December 1998. McWilliams out after a month in jail, denied AIDS medications during pretrial detention. Los Angeles, Peter McWilliams, the best-selling author and publisher, became a medical marijuana advocate after his 1996 diagnosis with AIDS and cancer, was denied critical prescription medications by federal authorities during his incarceration this past August on pot conspiracy charges. A federal magistrate imposed a $250,000 bond on McWilliams after his arrest on July 23rd, even though the author a month previously had publicly announced that he fully expected to be indicted shortly and offered to walk into custody any time he was summoned. If he'd been inclined to flee, he would obviously have done so then, but the DEA nonetheless chose to bust him in a pre-dawn raid on his Laurel Canyon house, accompanied with lurid press publicity that made it sound like an international dope ring roundup. A similar six-figure bond had been imposed already on one of McWilliams' alleged co-conspirators, cancer patient Todd McCormick. McCormick's July 1997 bust, High Witness News, November 97. High Witness News does a profile, and that's what we're reading now from High Times Magazine every month. For growing medical pot in a Bel Air mansion rented for him by McWilliams, provided the connection which the feds declared a conspiracy after a year of very public investigation. McCormick, who has a prescription for Marinol, was also denied his medication in jail before his friend, actor Woody Harrelson, posted his six-figure bond. He was denied it again as a condition of pretrial release. I see we have a caller coming into the studio. Caller, keep calling. We're going to turn to you, but it'll take 2 or 3 minutes while I finish this article. McWilliams began keeping a record of his medical treatment in custody from the moment of his arrest. To keep the HIV virus quelled in his bloodstream, McWilliams was taking a combination of protease inhibitors on a delicate daily schedule. Actually, let's take that caller, continue this in a moment.
Hi, caller. You're at Free Radio Santa Cruz on the air.
Hey, Robert. This is John Malkin.
John Malkin. Excellent. John, you're calling long distance.
It's true. From Botswana.
From Botswana, or Botswana, San Francisco in this case, huh?
San Francisco. I don't know what you're talking about on the air at the moment because I...
Well, we're talking with you right now.
Oh, good. I wanted to give folks a little more information about this forum that happened last Friday night, just 2 days ago in San Francisco.
Okay, Charlie, let me introduce you briefly, because we haven't played the tape-recorded segment that you and I just did.
Mm-hmm.
We're on the line now talking to John Malkin. John is a community activist in Santa Cruz for a decade at least, more or less, and he wrote his thesis on police violence, a shooting actually that happened back in 1991. He then helped to organize for a Citizens Police Review Board, was one of the first Citizens Police Review Board members who was actually on the board, and then was one of the first, well, probably not the first. I think you were you the first to leave the board? I'm not sure.
I think, well, you know, I replaced Carol Fuller, so she left. She was only on the board for a month or two. So I don't know if I wasn't really the first.
But you were actually the first. In my mind, although I always found you a bit too conservative for my tastes, but you were the man who rather persistently and continuously and deliberately pressed when police misconduct, particularly at an institutional level, became glaringly obvious in the issues of inquiries versus complaints, where Chief Belcher seemed to be suppressing calling some things inquiries and not supporting the police review board, when you yourself were harassed by Sergeant Clark for, I'm not quite sure what that was about. I guess he just didn't like you generally, right?
Well, this had to do with the issue of there being a lower number of complaints that year, I think in 1995, 1994.
That's right. That's what alerted you to the fact that there was such a drop-off in complaints. Then inadvertently, the police department revealed that it wasn't forwarding many of the complaints to the Citizens Police Review Board as required by its own directive C-7 and by state law, as well as by the city the law that set up the Citizens Police Review Board. And I think we talked about that at a past...
Yeah, we have.
And I'm going to pass on with that, because I know you are calling long distance. We have an interview we're going to play with you later in the show, I think.
Good.
Although perhaps you can talk now and summarize what you're going to be saying. You've been up in San Francisco for at least, what, a couple months?
Yeah, just a couple of months. And I just wanted to let people in Santa Cruz know about this forum that had occurred last Friday on October 30th.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a forum on police brutality and human rights abuse in the U.S., and it took place at the Socialist Action Bookstore on Cesar Chavez Street in San Francisco. And Dennis Bernstein was scheduled to speak, but he had to do a special report on Mumia Abu-Jamal.
That story broke yesterday, I guess, or the day before.
So he did not come, but a gentleman by the name of Van Jones was there.
I ran into Van Jones at the police commission, the group that actually oversees the police department in San Francisco, and they're dealing with the killer of, was it Aaron Mitchell? I believe that was the name of the activist who was...
Aaron Williams, not Aaron Mitchell.
That's correct, Aaron Williams. He died in a pepper spraying on the way to the hospital, and the community with Van Jones at the head of this group were just enraged at what had happened. I think they actually got the officer... That was his name, Mark. I'm not sure what his name, but anyway, one of the officers involved was either suspended or fired after several years. And so I'm familiar with Jones. He's a great, articulate African American activist, and he was at this meeting. You say?
Yeah, and he spoke about that case that you're talking about, and also a couple of other cases that have occurred this year. On May 13th, a plainclothes police officer shot and killed a 17-year-old woman, Sheila LaToy. And that actually occurred in the neighborhood where I live, although it was before I moved here.
You're in the Hispanic Mission Street area?
Yeah, well, a little bit south of there, but quite near there.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the police officer stepped in front of a car, and he was not identified as a police officer. And, Sheila was in a car with some other young people, and they drove by this person with a gun pointed at them, and he fired into the car and hit Sheila in the head and killed her.
I remember that made headlines, particularly in the Examiner, which covers these things in more detail than the Chronicle.
Right. Mm-hmm. And Van Jones, who's the national director of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, which houses the San Francisco and the New York City Police Watch, he said that there had always been hopes in San Francisco that because they have a supposed liberal district attorney, who I don't actually know too much about, but that's...
Carol Callahan, yeah.
Yeah, that's how they described, he described his hopes about this DA. It turns out that the district attorney is filing charges against one of Sheila LaToy's friends who was driving the car that she was killed in, when in fact she was killed by the police officer. Someone else is being charged with that crime rather than the police officer. He also, Dan Jones, described another shooting and killing of a citizen in San Francisco that occurred earlier this month. A 46-year-old man on 6th Street, this occurred, and there were 13 shots fired at this man, John Smart, who got in his car and tried to drive away from a scene where police had approached him. And it was interesting because Van remarked that, boy, that's a lot of bullets, 13. And there's
sounds like a case recently in Houston where a man was shot 9 times in the back in a bungled drug raid where they went into the wrong apartment, and I think he pulled his gun thinking he wanted to defend himself.
Mm-hmm.
And all the bullets were police bullets.
Uh-huh.
I think there were 13, 9 of them in the back.
Yeah, and it makes me think of the police shooting and killing that I witnessed myself in 1991 that I did mention in my thesis that I wrote at UCSC.
This was in Santa Cruz, 18 right?
18 bullets were fired at Carlos Machado by Santa Cruz sheriffs and police and other law enforcement officers, and half of those, at least half of those bullets missed him. According to the coroner, he identified 4 bullets that hit Carlos, and some of the bullets went into the mini mart at the gas station there on the corner of Ocean and Water. And at least one bullet went into a courtroom. And fortunately, people had adjourned from that courtroom shortly before that. But 18 bullets were fired at that incident. Van Jones also mentioned that...
Let me interrupt you just for a minute, John.
Mm-hmm.
Keep your thought. But, you know, that became an issue in Santa Cruz in March with the Button Street shooting of Brian Andrus, where mm-hmm. police fired 8 or 9 shots and into an apartment area, 2 of which ricocheted around. There was a 1.5-year-old baby in the apartment. There were 7 or 8-year-old children on the sidewalk. And this guy, Andrus, was only accused of wielding a baseball bat. He was actually, you know, defending himself, or actually he claimed to be defending his wife when the police broke into the house, allegedly to investigate a so-called domestic violence complaint after the woman, his wife, had said there was no violence there, and they could see that she had no bruises, and she was standing in full view at the window, asked the police to go away. They forced their way in without a warrant, without probable cause, without evidence of a serious crime, and so forth. And I know that we're doing this November 12th Happy John Dine protest coming up, where Happy John Dine was shot, of course, twice by Officer Connor Carey, allegedly for reaching for a toy gun, or if you want to believe the police chief, pointing in a combat stance a toy gun. It's a clear contradiction, it seems to me, between those two statements, but our Citizens Police Review Board has never found it fitting to go into the problems when in that contradiction. So firearms policy has been a real question here, I think, in Santa Cruz. It's never been investigated, and I know that when you went after that report, it took you, what, 2 years to get the report on Carlos Machado?
Oh, yes. Yeah, that was the whole story in itself. The district attorney's office agreed to give me a copy of the investigation of that shooting that occurred in 1991. And them giving me that was delayed and delayed. It was delayed once when the officer who was going to, or the DA employee who was going to give that to me, had to go to Los Angeles to be in the National Guard. He was a reserve person in the National Guard when the rebellion occurred regarding the Rodney King verdict. When he came back, I said, great, let's set up another appointment for me to come over and get this investigation. That was, incidentally, was completed in 6 days, the investigation of the shooting that involved 20 police officers, 18 bullets, most of the bullets were never accounted for. They didn't know where they ended up.
You know, irregularities around the shooting, and I'd love more details on that.
Yeah.
It was also the case in the Happy John Dine shooting, where they had a report out within 2 hours after the shooting confirming that it was, you know, the officer was exonerated. Within 24 hours, both the DA and the police chief gave a joint press conference, which they came up with a story later discredited by every single non-police witness that Dine was shot. Dine was wielding a pistol in a combat position at the officers. And then within 2 weeks, they came up with their final story, which had essentially the same conclusions, both the DA and the police department chief, Steve Belcher, which was overturned to some extent by the Citizens Police Review Board, which declined to do an independent investigation or hold public hearings. And similarly, in the Brian Andrus case, which happened again in March, and Andrus is still going and is still in trial, a jury found the DA's case impossible to swallow and hung about a month or two ago, but it also is coming back in mid-November to do it again. But the police records in the Andrus case were kept from the defense counsel for weeks after the judge twice ordered them to be released. They were kept from the defense counsel. I mean, it's what ordinary people would consider suspicious behavior if done by anyone other than the untouchable police. And the sad thing is that in the upcoming elections here in Santa Cruz, every single council candidate has nothing but positive things to say about the police department. You know, they're all gung-ho for this new $9 million police station. It's not that I'm trying to say one should be hostile to the police, but you have to take a critical attitude in circumstances like this when people are being shot. And investigation is not being followed up to see what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, go ahead. You were talking about the Machado case and the difficulties you had getting the DA's report, which we only got, of course, in the Dine case because Celia Scott was mayor and demanded it.
Well, yeah, I finally did get it after 2 years. It ended up that the district attorney didn't have it anymore. They didn't have their own report. They had destroyed it, they said. They had purged their warehouse because it was an old piece of information. It was a year old at that time and involved a police killing. They said maybe I could get it from the police departments that had been involved, and I contacted some of those departments and eventually got the report, or some of the report, from the Santa Cruz Police Department, who said they would give it to me for the fee of $3 for the first page and $2 for every page after that.
Bend over, John.
It was going to add up to $300 or $400 for this report. And I said that's a bit out of my budget. And I basically lobbied city council members to change that policy, which was the city policy at that time. When you went in to get a police report, that's what it cost, $3 for the first page, $2 for every page after that. And
now I think they charge you $12 for the whole report or something. Still outrageous for most reports.
Yeah, you know, Mike Rotkin changed that to that fee. And for my purposes, it helped me because I paid very little money then for that 100 or 200 page report. But I complained to him that that was not going to help most people who come in there for police reports. Most people come in for 3, 5, 7-page reports, and people are paying $12 for that, and that's...
Well, that goes to the policeman's ball fund, you see.
You know, interestingly, it's illegal for, as far as I know, it's illegal for police officers to be making money from photocopying documents. They are not Kinkos. And at that time, when I was doing this work, Catherine Byers let me know that she had found out that the police department that year had made an generated income of $20,000 from photocopying documents for the public. That's inappropriate. And I did actually investigate it. There's a penal code. There's a law about labor and office equipment and what government offices can and cannot make money doing. They're not a photocopying service.
You know, go ahead.
Yeah, and they, you know, anyway, I mean, that's
one instance of what would seem to be a form of misconduct by the police department that has never been corrected in Santa Cruz that I'm aware of. Did Catherine Byers agree to initiate some sort of a resolution in city council, or did she tell you that couldn't be changed because she didn't have a majority, or was she not interested? Or
I'm not sure how she felt about it exactly. Actually, my perception was she was surprised by it. She had not known that. But her I don't think she took action. I don't know of any action that she took about that. You know, I wanted to say a few more things about this event that took place Friday.
Sure.
I thought it was really interesting. This was the forum at the Socialist Bookstore on police brutality that Van Jones, the director of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights that oversees Police Watch, he spoke there, and a woman named Shannon Coughlin. She is co-founder of the Human Rights Solidarity Committee and Police Watch, and a man named Ali Bruce, who attended the Million Man and Million Youth March in New York City. And it was interesting, you know, to catch up on events that are happening here in San Francisco regarding police misconduct. That morning, just last Friday, October 30th, Van Jones described an incident that he had heard about and actually had some photographs of 90 San Francisco police officers and FBI agents in what he described as ninja uniforms, full black with black masks, burst into the Martin Luther King Jr. apartment complex and simultaneously burst into 13 or so different apartments, supposedly to break up gang activity. And they used shotguns in some cases to break in, to shoot out the front doors of these apartments. One apartment at least contained only a mother and an infant. Mothers and infants were separated and children were left in alone in different rooms crying and upset. That just happened on Friday, and what I'm hearing about Van Jones and Police Watch is that they focus on publicizing these events and the activities of the police and police brutality. And I'm sure, I think it's a good thing. People should know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
This gentleman, Ali Bruce, who attended the Million Youth March, brought photographs of that back. And that happened about a month ago in New York City and was almost stopped by the mayor, Mayor Giuliani, who tried to revoke the permit for that march. The police estimate of attendance at that march was about 10,000 people. And the photographs obviously show more than that. It was a huge, huge march that was sort of a companion march of the Million Man March. This was a march of African-American youth, young people, and there were speakers there and music. Apparently, according to Ali Bruce, who was there and who spoke at this event, huge areas were cut off so that people could not gain access to the march. Subway stations were cut off with police caution tape, you know, do not cross police area, and people were not allowed entry. There were apparently 3,000 police officers sent to that event, special for that event, at a cost of $1 million to the taxpayers.
I know that after that event, a similar police action in New York provoked a similar protest, in, at least in the media, when they arrested the folks in the HIV/AIDS march.
Right.
And they denied people medications for hours, which we've learned, I guess it was 3 or 4 days ago, that denying people the protease inhibitors, even for a brief period of time, can produce a resurgence of the deadly disease. And it's amazing that police would do this kind of thing. I mean, if only to protect their own legal vulnerability, if they do such a thing. It just shows the kind of out-of-control activity that's going on under Mayor Giuliani in New York City. Or is it a broader phenomenon, do you think, John, that's the case throughout the country because the police feel they can do what they want?
I think it's not peculiar to New York at all, mm-hmm. or San Francisco or Santa Cruz. People, when we worked to create the police review board in Santa Cruz, there were quite a few people who said that sounds reasonable in Chicago or New York or Los Angeles, but we don't really need that here. Or We need something like that, but not to the extent that they have it in other cities where police misconduct is a real problem. Someone who really espoused that point of view was Scott Kennedy at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I disagree. I disagreed with it then, and I disagree now. I think it's a international problem, really. And it's definitely a problem in the United States. And as Shannon Coughlin was saying at this forum Friday night, military technology is being passed to police departments all over this country now. And the amount of violence is increasing. And as Van Jones pointed out at the forum, this notion that it's only in Latino or Black communities that this is happening, or minority communities, is not true. And he's suggesting at looking at this a little different, changing the analysis a little bit. Minority groups are often focused on, and you know, there's countless stories of, and they were repeated at this event Friday night. If you're Black in a certain neighborhood, for example, Ali Bruce, this man who spoke about the Million Youth March, he grew up in San Jose, and he said that it was very common being Black in San Jose to be stopped by the police for cruising or other, you know, just hanging out just because of the color of their skin, and it's not uncommon. But Van Jones is suggesting, I think particularly because these two recent killings in San Francisco were of white people,
mm-hmm.
That it's not a race issue. And
now Van Jones is an African-American himself.
He is African-American. He's suggesting that it's maybe too limiting to analyze it in that way. And I think he's been greatly affected by the fact that these recent killings were of white people. One, a 17-year-old, Sheila LaToy, and 46-year-old, John Smart. The other thing that I thought was really interesting mentioned at this meeting was Shannon Coughlin of Police Watch mentioned this, that there's a group called Community United Against Violence, which...
concerned with anti-gay violence.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they have a hotline that people call and report hate crimes to them. Mm-hmm. And Shannon reported at this meeting that there's a huge, huge number of attacks on transgender people right now in San Francisco by the police, and that 70% of the transgender people who are calling Community United Against Violence to report hate crimes are reporting hate crimes committed by San Francisco police officers.
You know, it's interesting, down here there was a big rally at the town clock after the death of the Wyoming youth, you know, who was strung up on the fence and beaten to death, gay man. And I found it relatively kind of amusing in a bizarre kind of way that the speakers, Chief Belcher spoke, and Mayor Celia Scott spoke, and Sheriff Mark Tracy spoke about, you know, how bad all these hate crimes were. What they didn't tell us, and I distributed a flyer on the subject in the periphery of the crowd, was that the head of the hate crimes unit, for example, in the Sheriff's Department is none other than James Thurber, who is notorious for attacking homeless people, for charging them, harassing them. He's actually been, they've moved him from court to court because he makes the court personnel uncomfortable as a bailiff. Mm-hmm. He's actually literally kidnapped a young woman from the Aptos shopping center last December in order to give her a good lesson because he thought she was too young to be a college student, and he didn't like her responses when he was questioning her. I've interviewed her on the radio station. Similarly, in Belcher's department, the head of the hate crimes unit in his police department is has similar problems. And we need some sort of real thorough house cleaning of this, and maybe even, as you've suggested, I guess you haven't talked about it in this call, but you talked about it previously to me. The community needs to start taking responsibility for the functions that we've surrendered to the police department.
Mm-hmm.
and to do so in a fashion that doesn't involve shooting people, doesn't involve beating people up, but involves some other way. And I guess the Resource Center for Nonviolence, before it was taken over by Kennedy and Larson, was a sort of, you know, an alternate model for this. But now we have, I mean, I've got to talk briefly about Kennedy, not just because he's a bete noir of mine, and the worst disappointment of a decade, as I've described him recently in the Street Shit Sheet, but because he's pushing to have his cronies, his protégés, his I don't want to say his puppets, because that's a little strong, but maybe not too strong, on the city council in this upcoming election. Linda Steinau is, of course, his candidate. He wants to put her in power. Once she's in power, the Rotkin majority maintains power on city council. All they need is one vote. So Kennedy, as I understand it, was a man who, my impression was, he delayed and weakened police review for years, as part of the coalition to establish police review, and I, as part of SPAN, kind of working in parallel, tried to get this commission established in the midst of Butchie Baker's brouhaha, where this officer was accused of molesting essentially 10 women and then got Officer of the Year Award and the rubber stamp, a whitewash from the police department, the district attorney's office, and other bodies. What's your, you disagree with Kennedy on the issue of the Resource Center for Nonviolence, and his early history, did you find he was an obstructionist force in trying to establish a police review board with real powers?
You know, some of the terms we all agreed on, the idea of independence, openness, but these words have different definitions for different people, like all words, and the definitions can also change over time according to the needs and desires. The Coalition for Police...